For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show usually recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios in Camden. Today, I'm in the cupboard.
I'm Robert Kirkwood, and today I'm in my bedroom, but I've got my brand new microphone.
Excellent, all new toys.
And coming up in today's Read On,
Beth O'Leary will introduce us to her new romantic comedy, The Switch.
Saraban Publishing have more Cabin Fever fables.
Narrator John Banks leads us through his back catalogue of wonderful audiobooks. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Beth O'Leary's debut novel, The Flatshare, became a runaway success on its publication last year and is the best-selling romantic comedy of 2020. It's a perfect antidote to the current restrictions, and this week sees the publication of Beth's follow-up, The Switch. The audiobook version is a particular treat because one of the narrators is Alison Steadman.
It's been four lovely long months since my husband made off with the instructor from our dance class, and until this very moment, I haven't missed him once. I stare at the jar on the sideboard with my eyes narrowed. My wrist is still singing with pain from a quarter of an hour trying to wrench off the lid, but I'm not giving up. Some women live alone all their lives, and they eat food out of jars. I give the jar a good glare and myself a good talking to. I am a 79-year-old woman. I have given birth. I have chained myself to a bulldozer to save a forest. I've stood up to Betsy about the new parking rules on Lower Lane. I can open this wretched jar of pasta sauce. Deck eyes me from the windowsill as I rummage through the drawer of kitchen implements in search of something that'll do the job of my increasingly useless fingers. "You think I'm a daft old woman, don't you?" I say to the cat. Deck swishes his tail. It's a sardonic swish. "All humans are daft," that swish says. "You should take a leaf out of my book. I have my jars open for me." "Well, just be grateful. Your tea for tonight is in a pouch," I tell him, waggling a spaghetti spoon his way. I don't even like cats. It was Wade's idea to get kittens last year, but he lost interest in Ant and Dec when he found Miss Cha-Cha-Cha and decided that Hamley was too small for him and that only old people keep cats. "You can keep them both," he said, with an air of great magnanimity. "They suit your lifestyle better, smug sod. He's older than me, anyway, 81 come September. And as for my lifestyle, well, just you wait and see, Wade Cotton. Just you bloody wait and see."
Alison Steadman narrating The Switch, whose author, Beth O'Leary, joins me via Zoom. Beth, welcome back to Read On.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So I've got an advanced copy of The Switch and am thoroughly enjoying it. But for those who don't yet have the book, tell us a bit about the plot.
So The Switch is the story of Eileen and Lena, who are a grandmother and a granddaughter who swap homes for 2 months. So Eileen, the grandmother, moves down to her granddaughter's super cool, edgy London flat, and Lena moves up to her grandmother's beautiful little cottage in the Yorkshire Dales. It's a sort of novel, I'd say, about family. I mean, there's romance in there, but it's also about the bonds between women and how sometimes you need to make a big change when you're stuck.
It's a wonderful take on trading places, really, isn't it? Lena really does need the escapism of getting out of London and putting her life back in order. And her grandmother needs a bit of fun in life.
Yeah, I really wanted to write an older woman who wasn't at the end of an adventure, but was at the start of one. I feel like so often we read about people in their late 70s who are sick or dying. And actually, I felt like I wanted to celebrate, I guess, the spirit of my grandmothers when they were at that point in their life, full of life and fierce and funny and determined to do things their way, which is very much how Eileen tackles going to London and trying out online dating.
It's wonderful, isn't it? Sort of the Silver Surfer launching herself into the dating game in London and having that wonderful ability not to worry too much about what other people might think.
Which is something that Lena needs to learn, really. And by stepping into her grandmother's shoes and into her grandmother's world, she's sort of able to do that and notice just quite how much she cares about impressing everybody and asking herself why.
And I must say, it feels particularly apt for these times that it's never too late to start a new adventure. And it's also never too late to try and mend fences with friends and family members.
And I thought, I was also reflecting earlier that actually the, you know, this is such a difficult time to have a sense of community because we're all so isolated. But actually, people are finding ways to maintain their communities at the moment. And that's such a big theme in the novel as well. So that just, I thought, oh gosh, that's so interesting.
Well, yes, not all conversations have to be within 8 inches of each other's faces. I was really taken by the character of Letitia, the old cat lady who lives in the same house as Lena's flat. And just a conversation between Eileen and her sparks a wonderful friendship.
Yeah, yeah. She was an interesting one because I wanted her to have been overlooked by Lena and her London crowd. And really only through nothing malicious in it, but just they have busy lives and they didn't really think about the old lady with all the cats that lives in their building. But that Eileen would then, of course, reach out to her because they're a similar age. And then Letitia becomes as much part of the gang as any of the younger lot. And actually, she was one of those characters who you occasionally get that. I mean, Red, you write as well, don't you? That feeling where a character just does something entirely unexpected. And the moment when Eileen walks into Letitia's flat in London, the flat just started to sort of, as I was typing, just come to life around her. And it was really one of those moments where I thought, I've got Eileen's character. By getting Letitia and having them interact with one another, I felt like I learned so much about Eileen. And she wasn't really supposed to be quite such a big part of the story, but I kind of fell in love with her and she kept coming back.
It's wonderful. She just glows with potential all the way through. I found myself waiting for the next scene that she was going to appear in. I must say, you have really cheered me up over the last week. It's just like The Flat Share. It's a fantastically upbeat but also rather poignant novel that makes the reader reflect on our common humanity.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm really happy to hear that it cheered you up. I really love writing books that I hope uplift you and make people feel a little bit brighter, and that feels more important now than ever, really. I'm looking to books that do that a lot at the moment. Reading has really helped me in the last few weeks as we've gone through the UK going into lockdown. When I was editing the novel, it wasn't quite as upbeat as I wanted it to be, actually. It was a hard novel to write. The classic second album problem. I don't think I really quite worked out what the novel was until about 6 months after I'd submitted the manuscript to my editors. I did so much rewriting and reworking. And actually, it had sort of lost its joy a little bit at one point. And I'm so glad now that I'd put all that work in and that it's now a brighter novel. And I'm prouder of it almost because it was a tough book to write.
Well, it certainly does sparkle. And have you been able to bear to listen to the audiobook version? Because Alison Steadman is just terrific.
Oh, yeah, I've listened to a little bit. But as you say, it is hard listening to your own audiobook. You notice everything in your writing when somebody's reading it aloud. I love listening to audiobooks written by other people. But I do struggle to listen to my own. But yeah, both the narrators are just so perfect. I love the warmth they both bring in their voices. And I mean, Alison Steadman, I'm a huge fan. So I was just blown away when the team at Quirkus said that they'd managed to line her up for it.
Was that a total surprise to you?
It was a total surprise. I just got an email and I was like, what? So exciting.
She really has taken to the character of Eileen. She certainly inhabited her, didn't she? Obviously, all the in-person publicity around the launch of the book will have had to have been cancelled. Are you managing to do virtual book launches?
It's sort of at the minute a kind of time of trying to figure out like how much we can do remotely and online. And oh, it was painful watching all of the amazing events that the publicity team at Quirkus had worked so hard on. You know, it's months of work for them and a lot of things that hadn't yet been announced, and yeah, just dropping out of the diary because obviously, of course, they had to be cancelled. But now it's nice because things are starting to come back in because people are finding clever ways around things, and I'm doing a Facebook Live with a book club tonight and being able to chat to you on Zoom. We're finding ways. It's just kind of finding our feet in this new time and trying to work out how do you launch a book when you can't leave your house.
Well, it is remarkable. I don't think either you or I could have dreamed that we would be doing this interview over Zoom 2 weeks ago when we were planning on meeting up for this interview. Yeah. And yet, well, rather like Eileen, we have taken to the technology and embraced it and actually found it works for us.
Yeah, we have. And it's not the easiest time to be launching a book, but then at the same time, there's so much going on that's so sad and difficult. And if I can cheer somebody up with the book, even if it's just a few people, that would feel amazing. So it still feels very much worthwhile.
Oh, I think very much so. And especially upbeat books, I think, are definitely going to be the flavour of the next few months. I know you said before we started this interview that your partner is a doctor working for the NHS and obviously on the front line of all of this. What are you doing to fill your days at the moment?
Yeah, it is sort of strange him going out to work as normal when the rest of us are all obviously in lockdown. And of course, I worry about him. So it's good to keep busy. I'm actually employing a strict to-do list policy where I have in the morning, I sit down, I have my breakfast, I write a list of all the things I'm going to do. And every time I start to find myself slipping into worrying or wanting to obsessively check the news, I go and look at my list and find something else to tick off. And honestly, it's such a small thing, but it has helped a lot. And I'm starting to be able to write again. There was just so much to process when the announcements first started coming out about what a significant impact the coronavirus was going to have on our lives. People have talked about it as a grieving process, and I think that's very accurate. We all had so much to come to terms with that my creative bit of my brain just shut down, to be honest. I found it really hard to write. I was lucky because I had a few projects on the go that didn't really require that part of my brain. I was doing checks on the Americanized version of the book, so just checking for typos and spelling and things. You can do that almost mechanically. And now I feel like I'm just starting to reopen that part of my brain again and able to do my work. And I'm working actually on the very, very early beginnings of a fourth novel because my third book is currently with my editor. So I'm in that nerve-wracking period of waiting to hear what she thinks of it. So it's always good, I find, to reach for new ideas in that time. Otherwise, I just sit there and wonder what page she's on and where she's got to.
Goodness me, you've been busy. Can you give us a little hint as to what to expect, or is it too early?
It's very early. I've sent her a very raw draft, which is a little nerve-wracking, but I think as I sort of get further along and move from being a debut who is still in total disbelief that this has happened, which is definitely where I was when we last spoke, when I came in to see you and talked about the flat share, I'm now sort of at a point where I'm trying to figure out, okay, how do I keep doing this? But I've kind of really realized that actually your publishers and your editor are really there on your team, and it's helpful to get their input really early because it can really help me avoid writing myself down dead ends and things, having an expert eye looking at it early and saying, you know, what's going on here, you've lost your thread or whatever it might be. So yes, it's still very early, but I'll tell you the title, which tells you quite a lot. The third book is called The Road Trip.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, you heard it here on Read On First.
I'm pretty sure that when I came in to talk to you about the flat share, you got my first info on the switch there as well. So I seem to just get my exclusive info to RNA.
Thank you, Beth. And we were talking earlier about your reading habits. Is there a book that you plan to curl up with and reread as comfort food over the next couple of months?
Oh, that's a great question. And I love rereading. It's, for me, an ultimate comfort thing. I have actually recently reread a Vari McFarlane novel called It's Not Me, It's You. And she writes such brilliant, warm, witty, clever romantic comedies. And it's just like going back and meeting up with old friends. And her newest book, actually, which is called If I Never Met You, is another joy. It's out now. And it sort of comes back to that familiar romance trope of the fake romance, which is one of my favorites. And it has our protagonist has recently been dumped by her boyfriend of 18 years, and she still has to go to work and see him every day. So she engineers a fake office romance with the notorious office womanizer. And it's just pure joy. You know, it's funny, it's distracting, but it's also really poignant, and there's a lot of depth to it. And it really kept me distracted this weekend.
Well, I'm going back to the very welcome distraction of the Switch. I still have about two-thirds of it to go. So thank you for brightening my week. And thanks again, Beth O'Leary, for being a guest on Read On. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, again. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me back.
The Switch by Beth O'Leary is out now in print, ebook, and audio, narrated by Alison Steadman and Daisy Edgar-Jones. And members of the RNIB Library will find the Flatshare available in Braille and as TB24849, which is narrated by Carrie Hope. For more information, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number as ever, 0303 123 9999.
Here at RNIB, we understand that these uncertain times may be causing additional worries for people with sight loss. Our teams are working hard to increase our support for blind and partially sighted people to ensure they get access to vital information and help. Our advisors are providing advice and support related to the current situation, connecting people to local support and linking people up with social groups meeting online and over the phone. If you or a loved one need help, then please call our helpline on 0303 123 9999. The helpline is open 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. on weekdays and 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. on Saturdays. The number again, 0303 123 9999. Or you can email helpline@rnib.org.uk.
RNIB. See differently.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio, the show usually recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios, but for now, we're in bedrooms and in cupboards under the stairs.
Coming up later, narrator John Banks on the back catalogue of talking books he's recorded for us.
But now let's return to our friend Saraban Books for episode 2 of their Cabin Fever Fables. Saraban Books are an independent publisher in Scotland, and during this time of social distancing and self-isolation, they say that cabin fever is real. But Saraban don't want anyone to feel scared or alone, so they started a podcast, a place to share stories, spread calm, and have a laugh. Here's episode 2 of Cabin Fever Fables.
Hello. And welcome to Cabin Fever Fables. I'm Sarah Hunt from indie publisher Saraband, and this is episode 2. Each day, we're challenging an author to read a coronavirus-themed extract from their book. Whether it's on isolation, disease, fear, stockpiling, community spirit, or something else that will speak to us in these strange times of self-isolation. We're doing this to provide a short diversion from people's worries, if we possibly can. So we want to keep the tone positive. We're not minimising the very real fears and troubles out there, so much as trying to leave the doom and gloom to one side, even if only briefly. Not an easy task, but Graham McRae-Burnett got us off to a great start yesterday, and his cooking tips seem to have inspired some listeners already. Today's author is the inimitable Olga Voitas. Olga went to school at Gillespie's High School in Edinburgh, which was the model for Marcia Blaine's Academy in Muriel Spark's best-known book, The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. This novel provided the inspiration for Olga's character Shona, a librarian in a posh district of Edinburgh, Morningside. Shona is multi-talented, although not streetwise. But she does have the added advantage of being sent on missions involving time travel, something we'd probably all like to do right now. In Olga's new novel, Miss Blaine's Prefect and the Vampire Menace, Shona finds herself in a village in the French Alps. We're not going to hear about isolation, but about recipes for cheese and, even better, secrets of how to make booze from things you can forage for.
We headed back down into the village and into the main square, dominated by the statue of the monk with his hands upraised. Is that the village's patron? I asked. We don't know who it is, said the mayor. It's a memorial to the unknown abbot. Why are you commemorating him if he's unknown? I asked. We don't know who he was, but we know what he did, said the mayor, sounding suddenly pious. I was surprised. I didn't have him down as a religious man. But I suppose there's no reason why someone can't be both louche and a person of faith. What did he do? I asked. Heal the sick? Cleanse the lepers? Raise the dead? Cast out devils? He discovered how to make cheese. Ah, I said, blessed are the cheesemakers. I expected the mayor to laugh, but he simply nodded. Of course, the first cinema in France opened in 1899, but it would be a while before it screened The Life of Brian. The mayor gazed reverently at the statue. The unknown abbot was in charge of the nearby Abbey of Saint-Foy. He capitalised on the unique characteristics of the area to create a local cheese to tempt both the eye and the palate. Really? I didn't think abbots would approve of temptation. And do the monks still make the cheese? The mayor shook his head. Shortly after taking up cheese making, they also took up distilling eau de vie and died of alcohol poisoning. But according to legend, they went cheerfully. Alcohol can be more curse than blessing, I said. I suppose the recipes died with them. No, said the mayor, thankfully. I mean, yes. Yes. Gone. That is, the cheese making survives because the monks taught the local farmers, but the brandy recipe, that's disappeared forever. Probably for the best, I said. It reminds me of a poem by Robert Louis Stevenson called Heather Ale. It's all about the Picts, who lived in Scotland before the Scots. When it was Pictland, said the mayor. Let's not confuse things, I said. Just focus on the fact that the Picts brewed ale from heather. Anyway, eventually there were just two Picts left. What happened to the rest of them? Asked the mayor. According to the poem, the Scots had massacred them, but that's factually incorrect, so I wasn't going to mention it. They'd gone away, I said. Where to? Asked the mayor. Just somewhere else. So there were two Picts left. What were their names? Asked the mayor. I normally like people asking questions, but he was asking the wrong kind. We don't know, I said a little sharply. All we know is that they were a father and son, and they were very small. They were found under a stone, like snails. They were small as snails? No, they weren't as small as snails. They were small, but they were still people, just small people. The mayor's brow creased. Then it must have been a very big stone. Wouldn't it be better to call it a rock? So, they were found squashed under a rock. Did you hear me say they were squashed? I demanded. They were hiding under the rock, the stone. Why were they hiding? I was going to tell him that he'd find out sooner if he didn't keep interrupting me. And then I thought this was probably useful preparation for teaching the pupils the next day. They were hiding from the new king. The king was upset because he ruled over a land covered in heather, but he didn't know how to make ale out of it. This was the Scottish king, asked the mayor. It was just like the thing that he'd finally cottoned on to national sensitivities at the time when it was least appropriate. The poem doesn't say, I hedged. But you said, never mind what I said, let's just stick to the poem. All we know is that the king was quite bad-tempered. His troops found the very small father and son under a stone. How? Asked the mayor. They just did, I said. Look, do you know much about poetry? His sans-soleil pallor was darkened by a blush. Oh no, we don't get involved with that sort of thing round here. We know that poetry is decadent. Oh, a lot of your 19th century French stuff is, admittedly. But Robert Louis Stevenson wasn't French, despite his middle name. People pronounce it in the French manner, but that's entirely incorrect, I said. He was christened Louis after his grandfather, but the spelling was subsequently changed. Returning to the point is, while it's perfectly proper to interrogate the text for meaning, you can't ask questions about things that aren't in it, like people's names or how the king's troops happened to find two very small pits under a stone. But I haven't got the text, he objected. I don't know what's in it. That's why I'm asking. If there's anything you need to know, rest assured I will tell you, so there's no need for you to ask any questions at all. In fact, I'm just reaching the relevant bit, which I thought you would appreciate, given the disappearance of the unknown abbot's brandy recipe. The mayor looked down at the ground and kicked a pebble with the toe of his shoe. I wondered if he was sulking. To recap, I said, one bad-tempered king, two small pits. The king says he'll spare their lives if they give him the secret recipe. The father asks for a private word, tells the king that he's happy to pass on the information, but that since he's promised never to tell anybody, he thinks his son will be cross with him. I paused, but no questions were forthcoming. The mayor had now grasped how to approach the critical discussion of poetry. So, the father tells the king to tie the son up and throw him over a cliff into the sea. You may think these are extreme lengths to go to in order to avoid a family row, but in fact, the father has an ulterior motive. Have you worked out what it is? The mayor shook his head. I'll keep going then. Nearly finished. The son is duly thrown off the cliff to his doom. And then the father turns round and says he was actually worried about his son blabbing about the recipe, so that's why he had him done away with. The father knows that no matter what they do to him, he'll never tell, so the secret of Heather Ale is about to die with him. The end. The mayor gave a kind of strangled cry and raced off down one of the narrow lanes between chalets. His reaction proved the power of poetry to move its hearers. And he had only heard my precy of it. He would probably have been in floods of tears if I had actually recited it.
Thank you. Even though the link to self-isolating was pretty tenuous and you didn't actually deliver useful instructions on how to make the booze. Olga is of Polish heritage, and she says that in Poland, when martial law was lifted, three things remained on ration: meat, petrol, and sugar. There was actually plenty of sugar, apparently, but if you allowed free access to it, everyone just made vodka. I wonder if right now people would just make vodka or maybe make hand gel. Anyway, don't get any ideas. We know you're at home, but please don't try it. So where are we today? We've got our list of key workers for school closures. School's out for summer, you might say. I wonder whether someone will contribute a reading about keeping kids amused while they're bored. There's going to be no Eurovision Song Contest this year either, but for my money, Italy gets our 12 points and the award should go directly to the balcony singers. Now it's time for Olga to answer our four corona questions. You're in isolation. You're at home. What are you reading to pass the time?
I'm just about to start a new book, a newly published book. It's called The Lyre Dancers, that's L-Y-R-E, by Mandy Haggith, and it is book three of her Stone Stories trilogy. It's following the Walrus Mutterer and the Amber Seeker. It's set in the Iron Age, and I must admit, when I first saw that with the first book, I sort of thought, sounds a bit dreary. But the book actually had a gorgeous cover, and it was that, I have to confess, that attracted me first. Started reading it and was just riveted. Absolutely brilliant story, brilliant characters. Loved the first and second books. I know I'm going to love the third one. And what is even better is it has the most fabulous female protagonist. Always a plus.
What are you cooking tonight? I'm assuming it's probably something from your store cupboard.
I don't cook. I don't hold with it. But you needn't worry about me because my cupboards are already full. I have chocolate and I have condensed milk. And that's all I need.
Who would you choose to dine with tonight if we were not all self-isolating? It can be anyone. They don't have to be practical or nearby or people you know how to contact. Just pick your ideal companions.
That would be David Tennant. Although if he's coming round for dinner, I hope he can cook. Although maybe he'll be okay with chocolate and condensed milk.
What's the most idiotic or funny or noteworthy bit of corona advice or official tip or corona behaviour that you've seen today?
I've been somewhat bemused by the ongoings in France. Basically, if you want to go out of doors, you have to fill in a form that can then be produced justifying why you're out of doors. And one of the reasons you can legitimately be out of doors is walking the dog. And I thought, if you're out and you're walking and there's a dog with you on a lead, why do you need a form?
That's an excellent point. I hope our civil servants will try not to come up with silly questions on forms. And I hope you don't get any backlash for stockpiling condensed milk or chocolate. Should we start making a menu? Graham's Chinesey chicken and Olga's dessert. And how about maybe a seating plan if we had all the guests to one giant banquet? If you want to read Olga's or Graham's books or buy some books for the kids, please think about your high street. We're posting links to bookshops and websites where you can order for home delivery. If you live in Edinburgh, we know that Portobello Books, Golden Hare and the Edinburgh Bookshop are all offering local deliveries. That's all for today. I'm really pleased that yesterday's episode is being rebroadcast on the RNIB's Connect Radio.
And so is this one. Thanks very much to Sarah at Saraband Books. Their web address is saraband.net. That's S-A-R-A-B-A-N-D. And they're on Twitter at Saraband Books.
If you're a fan of talking books, TV dramas, radio shows, or Doctor Who spin-offs, John Banks will have a familiar voice for you. He's much in demand and is a frequent visitor to the RNIB Talking Book Studios, which is where I caught up with him in a break between recording sessions.
John Banks, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
So, tell me what you're working on at the moment.
I'm working on a really fascinating book, which is essentially the history of a man's family that he discovered as he sort of accidentally got into looking into his ancestry and discovered more and more, and it became a fascinating journey for him. The man in question is a publisher, actually. He's called Richard Atkinson, and the story is centered originally about his namesake ancestor, Richard Atkinson, who had a fascinating life. He was brought up in the north of England in what was then Westmorland. It's now been incorporated into the new county of Cumbria. He was essentially a self-made man, but who, in part of his dealings, became involved in Jamaica with the slave trade. So it was quite a revelation to the current Richard Atkinson to discover that one of his ancestors had been involved in such a, well, an incredible enterprise, if you want to call it that. But to have been involved in the slave trade at all was an absolute revelation to him. And I think it's difficult for him, as we could imagine, to in any way reconcile the good fortune of his family, which was in large part based on the absolute and terrible misfortune of those enslaved people who were taken out to Jamaica.
And the title actually reflects that as well, doesn't it?
Yes, it's called Mr. Atkinson's Rum Contract. And he made a lot of his money from selling rum to the army. He sold it all over the place. He sold it to the Navy as well, but primarily to the army. And he was obviously a very shrewd businessman and made a huge amount of money. And his forebears then sort of went on to create all kinds of businesses. And it's fascinating to hear how, for example, something like the Barings Bank came into being and his interactions with the East India Company and all sorts of other enterprises and all sorts of political enterprises that he got involved with. I actually did speak to Richard about this a couple of weeks ago, and it's obviously from a moral point of view and from our perspective, a very, very difficult subject. It's a fascinating period of history, actually a period of history I don't know very much about, as you can probably already tell, but it really is a fascinating book.
And you were saying before we came into the interview that the book has its own little set of problems, that there are an awful lot of Richard Atkinsons to deal with.
Well, yes, current Richard says in the book, and quite rightly, points out that his family had very little imagination when it came to naming their children. So we've got quite a few Richards, an awful lot of Georges, several Bridgets, a few Nathaniels and Nats, and there comes a point, I think, in the book where if you were to read the printed version rather than listen to the audiobook, he actually suggests that you go and have a look at the family tree that's printed at the beginning of the book to actually have any idea at all as to who that particular Matthew or Matt is, because they just go through from one generation to the next. And clearly, even now, we have a current Richard Atkinson.
How do you keep track of what's going on? What kind of preparation do you do?
Well, what I try to do is, with any book, whether it's non-fiction like this or whatever, is to find out who's actually doing any speaking in the book. And so I need to know as much as I possibly can about the characters of those people, because I need to somehow imbue them with a degree of humanity and a roundedness, perhaps, in the way that they express themselves. So there are a lot of things in the book that actually reveal what people did and how they reacted to various events and who their friends were. And descriptions of the characteristics that they might have had. So there is evidence to put together an idea of the sort of character that I might be trying to portray. The clues that I have, obviously, are primarily from this source of Richard's book. But what helps is that there are distinct regional accents. People in those days retained their regional accents far more than perhaps we do now. I mean, I'm originally from Yorkshire and occasionally the odd thing slips out. But mostly I speak in this sort of what you hear now, a sort of slightly neutral, I suppose, received pronunciation, you might call it. But in those days, people did that to a far lesser degree. So if someone's from Newcastle, they probably retained a Newcastle dialect. Or Scotland, certainly they would have retained their Scottish dialect. So that purely technically makes life a little bit easier for me. Having said that, I did try to research a Westmorland accent, and there's a wonderful archive at the British Library which got me back to 1954. And I have to say, a Westmorland accent in 1954 was just about impenetrable. I could make out the odd reference to a lamb or a sheep, and I think that was about it. So I thought, well, if you go back another 200 years, a Westmorland dialect would almost be its own language. So I, along with the producer, we discussed how we could slightly tone that out a little bit to make it more accessible. So hopefully there is still a flavour of where these people came from, and there's a bit of a regional dialect going on.
But do you want to give us a flavour now?
Well, I would just say that, you know, if you come from Cumberland, you might sort of talk a little bit like that, which is very, very close to North Yorkshire. And if you go a little bit further over from North Yorkshire to Newcastle, you sort of slightly sound like that. And it goes on and on and on. So those northern dialects beautifully blend into each other. And if you can locate, as I've got in my mind's eye, Westmorland, obviously over to the west of Newcastle, Newcastle on the east coast, and I'm trying to place these people between those two points.
Now, you're no stranger to biography. One of my favourite books that you've narrated in the library is Don't Ask Me, Ask the Dog by our own Mike Brace.
I did that one actually a few years ago, and it came about quite quickly. Sometimes I have an idea perhaps a few weeks ahead, or several weeks sometimes, of what I'm going to be doing. But that one actually popped up quite quickly. And as I remember, I think it was the second volume. But again, yes, a sort of a fascinating story about Mike's life.
Don't Ask Me, Ask the Dog, Mike Brace's autobiography, narrated by my guest John Banks, is TB24232.
And you've also recorded Alan Titchmarsh's.
Yes, again, another Yorkshire lad. Yes, and because Alan and I are probably not that far apart age-wise, I mean, he is older than me, but, you know, we're of a same sort of generation, I suppose, in some ways. A lot of that I found really interesting because he articulated a lot of the history that I could relate very easily from my own upbringing. I mean, his was a little bit more of the scenic Yorkshire. I mean, he's from Ilkley, so he's got the beautiful North Yorkshire countryside to have a wander around in. I'm from South Yorkshire, near Doncaster, and although there are arable lands around Doncaster, it was, certainly when I was growing up, very industrialised. and a lot of coal mines. There was obviously a huge railway works in Doncaster, a lot of construction work with things like international harvesters and the chemicals of ICI and all that sort of thing. So pretty heavy-duty industry, and I wouldn't have said that South Yorkshire was quite as pretty as North Yorkshire.
Now, the other thing that I associate you with is fantasy, partly because I've enjoyed a lot of the big finish Doctor Who continuations that you've recorded, but also because we've got quite a few fantasy titles narrated by you in the RNIB Talking Books Library, such as H.G. Wells.
Okay.
And the Necropolis series by Tim Wagoner.
Yes, the Necropolis series. That was one of the first long books that I ever did. Obviously, it was a series of three that I recorded. But I do remember thinking about those books. I mean, they were great. I have to say, they were great fun. They were quite Raymond Chandler-ish in some ways. It was the first time I remember thinking, how many characters are in this book? How many different voices do I have to come up with for this? I remember there was one character in the first book who had essentially 12 identities, and the 12 identities sort of morphed into each other, and some of them were animalistic, and of course everyone in it was a zombie. So it was an extraordinary world, and yeah, it was a fascinating challenge, but I do remember the first time I totted up the character count, and it came to something like 85 different voices, and I do remember thinking, how on earth am I going to have 85 different and immediately identifiable voices? So that was the challenge of that. And it was also the fun of that. As I say, I adored that sort of film noir aspect of it all. And I imagine myself as kind of a Sam Spade or a Humphrey Bogart wandering through this amazing world that was created.
In zombie form.
In zombie form, absolutely. And, you know, there are lots of sort of vampires and things. I mean, he really threw lots of things in there. And I adored, I mean, how could you not want to play a vampire?
You're also the narrator for a very exciting new set of books written by Josiah Bancroft.
Ah, yes. Josiah Bancroft. What an amazing man. I've actually never met Josiah, but we email each other quite frequently. And I feel a great affinity with him, I have to say. He wrote a book initially called Senlin Ascends. And it's about the adventures of Thomas Senlin, who is quite a naive and yet incredibly charming former headmaster who marries a woman who used to be one of his pupils, and they go off to the Tower of Babel on their honeymoon. And from there, the adventure really starts. They lose contact with each other quite soon after arriving at the Tower of Babel, and it all presents itself as a completely new world to him. And he really has to look inside himself to find out what kind of human being he is. And it's a beautifully constructed set now of three novels and a fourth, I think, about to come out perhaps this year. He creates such an incredible world. It's very different to our world, obviously, but it's not so different that we can't immediately relate to it. So it's not as though we're going back 1,000 years and we have dragons roaming around the countryside and we're sort of interacting with a supernatural world or anything like that. In a way, it seems quite familiar. And yet, he looks at the world in such an oblique way that the things that Senlin is assuming, as we as listeners and readers are assuming, are always slightly off-kilter. There's always a little bit of challenge that goes on there. And the sort of experiences that he has are exactly the kind of things, when they're distilled down, that we have in our daily lives. And we sort of think, how do we get through these situations? How do we make sense of things? And his journey is very much one of trying to make sense of where he is and trying to learn about how this amazing, incredible environment that he finds himself in is affecting him and causing him to rethink the way he behaves. Which isn't to say that it's moralising. I don't think it's that at all, really. But it's just, it articulates beautifully the fact that none of us really knows where we're going or what we're doing. We are always reacting to what happens to us. I find the character immensely sympathetic, and I've already picked out the character I want to play if it's ever made into a movie. Fantasy genre has certain connotations, and I think this is almost creating a new genre, actually. I have to say, if you were to wander into a bookshop, it probably would be found in the fantasy section. But I wouldn't want that to put anyone off who thinks that, oh, well, we've got thousands of orcs about to come over the horizon and I'm not really into orcs or anything like that. This is really a world of its own, and I would urge anyone to actually have a look at, certainly start with Senlin Ascends and see where you go. I don't think it's even a Marmite sort of thing. I don't think you'd pick it up and think within a few pages, this is really not for me. I think you'll be seduced by it. I think you'll be drawn into this incredible world. It's also a very gentle world in some ways. Immense cruelties occur, but the people that we're really rooting for are very gentle souls. And it seems such a shame at times that very terrible things happen to them.
I'm often struck by how attached narrators get to some of the books that you narrate. It's more than just a job, isn't it?
Oh, it really is, yeah. I've come to narrating books after 30-odd years as an actor in theatre and TV, which I'm still doing. I mean, that's still a parallel part of what I do. But I have to say, being allowed to create multiple characters and creating worlds in a listener's imagination is such an immense privilege and such tremendous fun to do. Once I'd got over the initial terror of literally sitting in a quiet room and not moving around and not making a noise and overcoming the physical and technical requirements of actually being somehow able to articulate a story, it became just such a liberating pleasure to do that, to actually immerse yourself to such a degree in portraying characters that it's almost, without sounding hopefully ridiculous, it's almost a transcendental thing that by the time we're all going home, it feels like maybe 10 or 15 minutes has passed. It's an incredible thing if you can be so focused and so immersed in a world that a very clever author has put together. It is an absolute privilege and actually, of course, a great responsibility. If I don't articulate the author's intentions very clearly, or if I go off at a tangent, or if the characters that I'm creating aren't credible, then it's going to negatively impact on the author's entire career. The book that I'm recording now here has taken 9 years to write. So I take that very seriously. I don't go into this in a flippant way. I do my absolute best to articulate what I believe to be the author's intentions. And as an actor in theatre, for example, you're given weeks sometimes to rehearse and to forensically have a look at the text and to work with the director and work in concert with other people in the cast. In an audiobook situation, I have a producer who may know the book very well, or perhaps if there's little time, might not know the work very well. So the responsibility is mine. It's my choice. My choices of how a character sounds, what voices to use, how to pace the thing, how to, as I say, reveal what I believe to be the author's intentions. And it is a wonderful privilege, but if I ever sit back and think about it, it's quite terrifying.
Is there any accent that you dread coming up in an audiobook?
Lots. I do love doing accents, I have to say, because accents can be an absolute way out of thinking, well, what can I do for this character? If you can give them an accent, then that really helps. I find actually a Manchester City accent, I find that very difficult because
You're a Yorkshireman.
I'm a Yorkshireman, and it's about 70 or 80% the same. So to actually make it very clear is quite tricky. The further away you go, the easier it becomes. I've actually just done a book that was set in Birmingham. Now, I was at university in Birmingham, and I loved the Birmingham accent, so it was quite easy to sort of slip into it, you know, and do all the characters. But then you thought, now, hang on, I can't really do all the characters in a heavy Birmingham accent. So then it became an idea of how strongly or otherwise to actually give the characters a proper Birmingham accent. And then you get into the territory of status and experience and whether these people have moved away from the area and then moved back or if they're, you know, all of those elements can go into just a single accent. So a variety of pitch, tone, speed, all can change the way we perceive status, gender, obviously, playing men, women, children, and in the Doctor Who stuff that you talked about, playing creatures. I've played a fog, I've played a swarm of leeches, you know, all kinds of things. And I can only say that if it fires your imagination and you have some sort of dexterity with a dialect or whatever, and it's pertinent to the story you're telling, fantastic. Get on with it and let it go. But anything that's too close to Yorkshire, or even actually, to be really pedantic about it, as I say, I'm from a former pit village near Doncaster, so I had quite a pronounced Yorkshire accent until I went to university. And I find actually, bizarrely, if I have to go back and replicate that accent, I tend to overdo it, which sounds really odd, because I've slightly lost the ability to hear my own childhood voice without it being slightly over-egged, if you like, which is very odd.
It's funny, I'd never thought of a narrator as a casting director as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I did a series of 8 novels written by Dorothy Dunnett called The House of Niccolo. That's the entire series. And it ran for 215 hours and had 1,473 characters. So I had to cast all those characters. I had to give most of them a voice. you've pretty much got to have an imagination that establishes people in your mind's eye so that you can immediately tap back into how they sound. That series of books spanned a huge amount of time. You do have to cast those people. Any shortcuts that I can use? I tend to use a fabulous actor who's sadly no longer with us called Alan Howard, who I used to go and see when I was at university at the RSC. He was a stalwart of the RSC and had the most amazing voice. And I remember going to see him at the Almeida Theatre reading the Iliad. And it was one of the most incredible experiences in the theatre I've ever had. It was the man on stage reading the Iliad. So I actually had the great pleasure of working with Alan Howard once, many years ago. And it was one of those things, I was so overwhelmed by him. I of course, didn't say anything to him, apart from probably looked a little bit doe-eyed at him occasionally. Especially for the high fantasy stuff. If you can channel a little bit of Alan Howard and occasionally throw in a bit of Richard Burton, that makes life a lot easier. And so anyone I've ever seen in a movie or anyone I've ever met will be considered for a character. Certainly in the Dorothy Dunnett series, I used one of the characters from Westworld as the lead female voice. And I always refer to her in my mind's eye as the character Dolores from Westworld. It was a very quick way of latching onto someone who spoke in a particular way and had a certain coolness to them. But then, of course, when you get into the studio, you've got to be prepared really to let go of pretty much all the ideas that you've had. I wander around at home practicing a voice maybe, which I don't do very often, but sometimes you get into a studio and suddenly realise that it's actually not going to work. Your voice is now being piped through thousands and thousands of pounds worth of electronic kit, and it doesn't sound the same as it does in your head or wandering around the house. So it's also important not to overcommit to a particular idea because you might have to just let go of it. If you feel as you're recording it that it's not working, you've got to have a backup. There's got to be something else that you can do. So it's not just a question of ploughing on with the first idea. It's a strange business, I have to say, a little bit like casting and directing and appearing in your own movie. And of course, that's massively appealing to any actor, I would imagine.
Is there one book that you've recorded for the RNIB that's really stuck in your mind that we can play out the interview with?
Do you know, there is. There is a book that I did probably about 8 years ago, and it's called The Rescue Man. And it was set in Liverpool during the war, and there were heavy rescue teams, obviously, who went into bombed buildings to look for people, to see if there were any survivors, and then to deal with them and care for them. I've read an awful lot of military history, I mean, just as a personal pastime thing, but it had never really come home to me the level of destruction and mayhem that occurred in Liverpool during the war, which is very stupid of me. I mean, why on earth would I not know that? But this book was, again, beautifully written and incredibly evocative, and I had great sympathy for actually pretty much all the characters. There was obviously some negative influence in there, character-wise, but I did identify very strongly with the characters. I wish I could now remember more about it. I've got the text at home, but I've never heard it. And I was, at the time, very proud of it, I seem to remember. And I was very keen to hear it. I always try to listen to everything that I've done, obviously looking for errors and trying to make it better for the next time. But this particular book was set, as I say, in Liverpool, and it required me to do a variety of Liverpudlian accents. And I wanted to be sure that I'd got it right. I wanted to be sure that people weren't thinking, what on earth is he trying to do? Is he trying to sound like one of the Beatles or something? So yes, that book had a great impact on me when I read it, a great emotional impact, actually. And it was a very tender love story as well. Really evocative, actually. And I would urge you to have a listen to it. And I would love to have a listen to it.
We will play out with a clip of that.
Oh, now I'm on the spot.
Well, John Banks, thank you so much for giving up your lunch hour to come into the Read On studio. And I very much look forward to hearing far more of your voice in years to come.
Oh, you're very kind, Red. Thank you very much for asking me. The address he had been given was a road off Sefton Park, just south of the city. Baines, having taken a tram, had stepped off some distance away, convincing himself he wanted to walk through the park. In truth, he was looking for an excuse to delay his arrival. He was becoming more inclined to dilatoriness these days, as if by huddling in the present he could somehow hold back the incoming tide of the future. It seemed that everybody was waiting, tensed and trembling like divers on a cliff. And yet, in much else, he had to admit that the spirit of business as usual prevailed. The previous afternoon, while looking for blackout curtains at the Bon Marché, he had noticed a young man trying on a top hat. It was nearly 9 o'clock on a cloudless June morning, and the heat seemed also to be collecting in weight. The grass in the park had a withered, yellowish tinge. He was amazed and vaguely appalled that individual days could roll on in their oblivious, humdrum way. A A woman pushing a pram strolled past. Birds were tuning up in high, discordant keys. Only the distant tap-tap of a hammer caused him to look across at the glinting windows of the farmhouse, where a team of workmen were boarding up its fragile shell. At the park's perimeter, two more workmen were painting the curbstone black and white, a guide to nighttime traffic once the street lamps went dark. Here was urgent work, albeit languidly undertaken. Could there be such a thing as languid urgency, he wondered. In any case, somebody had looked ahead, assessed the risk, and made a decision. And the decision was to camouflage as much ground as possible. Baines stood gazing at the painters as they inched their way around the curb, their glossy trail of black and white snaking far behind them. As an augury, he felt that it lacked poetry. If disaster must be presaged, there ought to have been an albatross haunting the seafront, or a comet striping the night sky. He dawdled on. The cobbles of this road were as familiar to him as his own footfall. He must have been 10 or 11 years old when he first rode a horse right the way round this park. He could recall the exhilaration of feeling its girth strain beneath him, and later his annoyance when its hooves no longer clattered on the stone. Straw had been spread along the road to muffle the clopping and thus spare the slumbering residents of the grand houses an unwelcome reveille. Lacking inspiration for further postponement, he turned at last into the quiet, tree-shaded avenue and made his way towards a row of terraced cottages built in the middle of the last century and recently abandoned. He saw Jack at the end of the row, leaning against the wall, a cigarette on the go. "Give me one of those, would you?" Baines said. Jack pushed himself off the wall and, without a word, tossed over his pack of players to Baines. "Lose your way," Jack deadpanned, expelling a plume of smoke through his nose. Baines, fishing out a cigarette, accepted the implicit reproof. "Sorry, just fancied a walk."
My guest, John Banks, narrating The Rescue Man by Anthony Quinn, which is TB20944. For a full list of books narrated by John Banks in the RNIB Library, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999.
Alas, that's all we've got time for this week.
No time today for Books of Your Life, but we've got a very special John le Carré Books of Your Life next week.
If you can't wait that long, we're always available as a podcast. There's 163 hours of us talking about books available on our Audioboom page. Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On.
And you can always follow us on Twitter. I'm at Red Sail, which is REDSZELL, and producer Robert
at Talking_Books.
Farewell until next week, and in the meantime, stay safe.
Stay home and lose yourself in a good book. See you next week.